Femfas. Femfas. Femfas.
Hello and welcome to Femfiles. I'm Becky.
I'm Josie.
And I'm Ellen. We're three history geeks with a passion for pop culture and a fascination with iconic female figures.
Each episode, we compare two women, one from the past and one from the present. We'll be looking at how their lives interlink and exploring what, if anything, has really changed.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Femfiles. This week, we're looking at two domestic goddesses. Becky will be telling us all about the Victorian culinary expert, Mrs. Beaton, and Josie will be spilling the tea, quite literally, on celebrity food writer and broadcaster Nigella Lawson. We'd like to thank everyone that's kindly left us a review on Apple Podcasts. And remember, you can follow us on Instagram at FemFilesPodcast and on Twitter at FilesFem.
Guys, we survived 2020.
Just about.
To be fair, that this was the best thing to come out of 2020 for us, for sure. Launching the podcast 8 months in, and we've actually managed to produce one episode every month other than August, which honestly, I just never imagined that we would do.
Yeah. What are your favourite moments from this adventure?
Well, it's quite hard to choose. There's been so many. I feel like I've got to learn a lot about history through doing this, and sometimes the characters which are expected to like least that we've covered, I've actually found an affinity to in some way. Like, I very much enjoyed finding out about Marie Antoinette, not somebody I was interested in before recording. And actually, that was my favourite episode to do because it was recorded about the time that we were actually allowed to hang out.
Yeah.
And we went for a barbecue and I got a bit slozzled and then came back to the recording. And that's when the political prawns fiasco happened.
Iconic. I feel like my most fun memory definitely has been Josie's terrible French pronunciation throughout the course of a couple episodes, the Joan of Arc episode in particular.
Oh dear, yeah. What's my favourite moment? I can't even think of one. I have to say, I agree with Ellen. I think of particularly finding out more about characters that I originally had absolutely, well, not characters, but people that I originally had absolutely no interest in. So like Meghan Markle for me. I'm not a royalist. I've never really been that interested in the royal family. And actually, she is so fascinating. And I kind of love that that was our first episode. But I definitely, in 2021, let's redo it because it's such a good one. And I think there's so much more to cover. And also, I can't bear to listen back to how we sounded in our first episode.
And how can we forget about, shout out to Agincourt, Becky Wilde's greatest moment.
Yeah, I lost the plot in that episode.
That was the Joan of Arc and Greta Thunberg.
Yeah. Good times.
Yeah, good times. So I've got you two a little somewhat Femfiles related present, as it is Christmas, which I posted to you. And so if you wouldn't mind unwrapping it now.
Oh, I'm
telling the listeners.
I feel so spoiled. I'm so bad that
I'll wait to see what it is.
You guys, anything.
Thank you so much, Ellen.
Should we open the cards first, Josie?
Yes.
Hopefully this is like some ASMR shit for people, like... The paper.
You have to whisper.
Sorry.
Oh, love it. Aww. Very traditional card, Ellen. I'm a fan.
They were actually the most reasonably priced from the shop I went to.
Also, fabulous.
There are economical reasons behind it.
Fabulous nutcracker paper on here.
I've got some lovely reindeer paper.
Oh my god, this is probably the best present I've ever been given. No joke.
So to the listeners, I have got Josie.
That's why I'm showing people.
So people can see. A Frida Kahlo cutout doll. And for Becky, I have, well, she's got a King Henry VIII and his seven wives paper dolls.
Seven?
Blasphemy.
Sorry.
Blasphemy.
Six wives.
Oh my gosh, honestly, when I say this is one of the loveliest presents I've ever received, it's so me. I used to love paper dolls and I've always loved Henry VIII, so this is like perfection for me. Thank you so much, Ellen.
I thought we could decorate our recording studio with them.
Oh,
with them.
Hell yeah.
Oh my gosh. When I was at uni, a really lovely girl in my halls had the book and she gave all of us one individually, and it was Louis XIV, would that be right, the Sun King?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. His mistresses. And I was opposite a girl who had the clothed Montes de Mantes. I like the fact we've taken the piss out of Jason for not being able to say.
Contes.
French names, but something de Montespan, Madame de Montespan. She had the clothed one and I had the nude version on my door. So
love it.
Things also makes it uni.
I'm definitely going to hang these up around our podcast studio for when we're all allowed back together. Hopefully in 2021 we'll be recording in my box room surrounded by Henry and his wives.
Fingers crossed.
I cannot wait to cut out Frida. That is such a cool present.
Oh, good.
And my mum will also be stealing this as well, because my mum is obsessed with paper dolls.
She? Yes. Oh, God. I love the illustrations for that one as well. I think it's a really beautiful piece of art.
Yeah, it is really nice.
So without further ado, let's jump aboard Nigella Express and delve into the lives of these two women. Becky, tell us all about Mrs. B.
So, Isabella Mary Beaton had a short but eventful life. She was born in 1836, and her documentation of middle-class Victorian domestic life revolutionised how women ran their homes. In 1856, she married Samuel Ocart Beaton. Ocart or Ochart? Ochart.
Oh, sure. Shit.
Don't trust any of my pronunciation.
Samuel Beaton, let's call him, an ambitious publisher and magazine editor, which gave her an in to the London literary scene. In 1861, they published Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, which sold 60,000 copies in the first year, 2 million by the second, and it's never been out of print since. One historian describes its sales as second only to the Bible. Unfortunately, she died aged 28 in 1865 of childbed fever, essentially a doctor not washing his hands straight after she gave birth, or there is another theory that it might have been syphilis related as well. Either way, she died far too young. One of the most famous quotes from her book, which I really think sums it up, is, "As with the commander of an army or the leader of any enterprise, so it is with the mistress of a house." For decades, it was the most frequently consulted cookery book until the modern TV chef came along. Nod to Nigella there. Such is her fame that the Oxford English Dictionary states that by 1891, the term Mrs. Beaton had become used as a generic name for a domestic authority. She's basically a brand name, much like Nigella, who doesn't even need a surname to determine her.
Wow, so quite a lot to sink our teeth into. Tell us more about the sort of environment Mrs. Beaton operated in the Victorian era.
So to expand a bit on the social context of the time, there was a huge rise in the cult of domesticity for women, and she's considered as a key figure in shaping the role for women in the Victorian middle classes. We have to remember how many children people were having at this time. For instance, her mum had 4 children with her first husband, Isabella's dad, right? Then he died. And then she married a new guy. He also had 4 kids. So you'd think, oh, you know, they've got married. They've got 8 children between them. They'll probably stop there. They went on to have 13 children together, which left them with a total of 21. So I just want you to imagine why a woman would have any time to do anything else if she had 21 children. It's not surprising that Isabella grew up in a world where domestic duties were just her entire existence. And yeah, women's roles were sort of carved out just by the fact that they were baby making machines and they couldn't really enter the workforce. In addition, the new Victorian emphasis on the comforts of hearth and home elevated the lady of the house to angelic heights, an idealised, charming, subservient wife and gentle, doting mother whose marital duty was to organise the running of the home and meet the needs and comforts of the entire family. But women coming back into the home, or at least women of a certain class coming back into the home, was a fairly recent phenomenon for the Victorians. It was actually something that they had cultivated, this image. So in the centuries leading up to the Victorian era, women really actually had been quite active in working, especially in brewing. So I think this idea of women having always been there is something that we think of, but it's not actually necessarily the case. And it was something that an image that the Victorians conjured up, and the Queen even exemplified it, Queen Victoria. She was very, very domestic. Her and Albert put out a complete image of like bliss, and they had all these kids. As the middle classes expanded in industrial Britain, it was felt that the nouveau riches might need guidance on how to conduct themselves in polite society. Step in Mrs. Beaton and her hubby, cottoning onto the zeitgeist and profiting massively.
Josie, tell us a bit about Nigella. Who she is, and how does she come to be the icon we know and love?
So Nigella was born in 1960 to Nigel Lawson, a very, creatively named child. And he was a former Conservative Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Vanessa Lawson, whose family owned, and I've not actually heard of them, but apparently they're very well known, Jay and Lyons Co. So I think it no longer exists, but it's a well-established British restaurant and food chain. So obviously food and culinary experiences is very much in the family. And so I think we can probably all agree Nigella kind of represents the epitome of middle class. She grew up in Kensington in Chelsea. She was extremely well educated. She graduated from Oxford with a degree in medieval and modern languages. I wouldn't even know what medieval languages would be.
We could get her on the podcast as an expert.
Yeah. Bizarrely, she loves German. I was listening to an interview with her, and Mrs. Beaton spoke German because she was educated in Germany for a period, was also a bit of a linguist.
Oh, yeah. Nice crossover. So again, we can draw some parallels here with Mrs. Beaton looking at education, and I think the fact that they both focus very much on the middle class. And at a young age, only at 23, she started her career in journalism, and she was very successful. So she became an editor at The Spectator, and then shortly after a deputy literary editor at The Sunday Times. She was only 26 at this point. So around this time, she moved from primarily focusing on book reviews to becoming a restaurant critique, which in my opinion would be like the best job ever. You just get to eat food. And she carved out a career writing food columns for Vogue and American food journals Gourmet and Bon Appetit.
My favourite. I use it all the time.
Really?
Yeah, genuinely. It's the only sort of like reference point for me in terms of cooking.
Also, Josie, great pronunciation of Bon Appetit.
Yeah.
So this led to her publishing her first cookbook, How to Eat, Ellen's Favourite, 1998, shortly followed by the ironically titled How to Be a Domestic Goddess in 2000. And again, I think obviously it was ironic, but I think we can start to see some similarities with Mrs. Beaton here. And these books became instant hits and led to her own cooking show, Nigella Bites, hosted on Channel 4. Since then, Nigella has hosted 12 cooking shows, published 14 cookbooks, and won 7 awards. I feel like that's the, what do you call it, 12 Things of Christmas song, like
7 culinary awards. Guys, do you think that Nigella Bites is meant to sound suggestive? Is it?
I feel like,
is it a bit sort of like of a?
I can't tell with Nigella.
My bite.
Rare.
It's difficult with Nigella because she's obviously very good looking, and I never know how much of it is she's playing on her sexuality and how much of it is just like she is genuinely so sexy that no matter what she does, it's sexy.
I don't know. She's very shy apparently in real life, but whenever you listen to her talk, she's very adamant that she isn't doing these double entendres on purpose. But having watched the programme, I think we can all agree, it's very suggestive.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that she dresses as well, I think perhaps less so now than in the past, but she used to sort of pretty much only wear tight cashmere jumpers.
Show off those hourglass curves. Mm. The ruin of dads everywhere.
So, how did Mrs. Beaton shape home cooking, and how we celebrate events like Christmas?
So, Mrs. B learnt her pastry making skills in Heidelberg in Germany, as you mentioned, Ellen, where she learnt German, and further when she returned to London. Although I'm not sure that she was actually an excellent cook, I just think she was an excellent curator of other people's recipes, which is part of the controversy around the book. There's not a lot of it is her original work. And although women had been noting down their recipes for centuries, and even publishing since the 1700s, Mrs. B's book of household management displayed the recipes in a highly organised way and with illustrations. So suddenly people had access to information and they could actually structure their Christmas around her suggestions rather than having to rely on word of mouth from their mother or having to learn it. So I think it probably really, really changed how people organised their celebrations. At the time of her writing, the concept of a festive Christmas with fir trees, decorations, cards and crackers was rapidly becoming established in Victorian Britain, influenced by the writings of Charles Dickens, royal practice and the revival of ancient customs and a rising tide of consumerism. Some seasonal dishes were already centuries old, such as the Christmas pudding, whilst others were more recent innovations, and Mrs. Beaton published a number of these in her book, including a fruitarian plum pudding, and I'm wondering, it was basically like for vegetarians because it didn't have suet in it, which was quite revolutionary, I imagine, for the time, and stuffing and also Christmas cake, all the classics really, but I particularly love her quote about the turkey. So she says, "A noble dish is a turkey, roast or boiled. A Christmas dinner with the middle classes of this empire would scarcely be a Christmas dinner without its turkey."
I just love that she's describing a turkey as being noble.
I know, it's actually really funny.
Do you guys have turkey for Christmas?
I hate turkey. It's so bland.
I do have it though,
do usually. You?
But now I'm trying to be a vegetarian, so I'm not having it this year.
Okay.
What do you have at Christmas?
We do tend to have turkey, but we only have turkey crown, so not the actual full bird, because there's only three of us. So
fair.
But I agree, it is bland and it is dry.
What do you have, Jace?
Well, this year we're having chicken.
Okay.
But my sister's vegan, so we're having a vegan second Christmas after as well. So it'll be interesting to try both.
Wow.
Maybe she should try the fruitarian plum pudding.
So from turkey to ham, I know about Nigella's famous Kola ham, which features in Gavin and Stacey. But how do you think Nigella has influenced Christmas cooking, JC?
So I feel like this is not my area of expertise. And I have to be honest, like, I love eating food. I have no idea how to cook it or prepare it. So I find it very difficult to comment on how Nigella has shaped the influence of food and Christmas. But apparently when I did some research, she came up with a revolutionary way of cooking roast potatoes that blew everyone's minds.
Oh, goose fat. That was it. Yeah, my mum did that and it was because of her. Yeah, goose fat. Potatoes.
I hate to be rude, but I don't think that's revolutionary.
It was described in The Guardian, Becky, as being revolutionary.
Well, I've never had a potato without goose fat.
Exactly. Nigella.
Well, I think that's the thing with Nigella. She's not actually sort of coming up with original ideas. She's just repackaging old ones and bringing it to a mass market like Mrs. Beaton. So Nigella seems to very much present herself as a food writer, not a chef. The same was true for Mrs. Beaton. Tell me more.
So I think this is a really interesting question, and I found a really good article that I'll link to in the show notes. But Nigella gave an interview where she was actually asked what basically makes her different to being a chef. And she talks a lot about how there's a strong network of women writers, and she talks about the tradition of making food, and that basically with men, they're often seen as being chefs, and it becomes this performative action that's very difficult to achieve and it's very prestigious. While in contrast, you have women who are preparing dishes at home, and it's not really put on in the same platform. And so she basically said that she was very uncomfortable by that and wanted to create a way that women can prepare food without having to actually feel like they're putting on a performance, and to just simplify it. And I'll quote her here. She said, "Men are talked about as these great creators, and women are talked about as cozy creatures." And I just really like that little bit because I think it's so true.
So she wants women to be celebrated for what they're achieving in the home by putting on these spectacular meals for their families as much as a chef in the industry. Is that what she's trying to do?
See, I'm not sure actually if it's that, or if she's trying to simplify it so that women don't feel the pressure to put these amazing feasts. So I think that, for example, it's actually almost what Mrs. Beaton's trying to do. It's trying to simplify it for women so that they don't feel this great pressure to perform. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, also, when a man is able to cook a roast chicken, it's not like, oh my God, next Jamie Oliver. You know, it's like, well done. You did what women everywhere have been doing for hundreds of years. I think that's what she's saying, but you can read the article and let us know what you think.
So we're going to touch upon the slightly thorny subject of body image. Nigella has discussed having a tricky relationship with food. What do you think her impact has been on the way that women see themselves?
This is a subject that I'm really interested in. And obviously we all know Nigella as being like the curve icon, like she's got the ideal hourglass figure. But I think that in the present day, we still see it. There's this need, we see it a lot in social media, where people want to overcomplicate food and nutrition, exactly what I was saying Nigella tries not to do. And it's, you know, I'm sure, especially during lockdown, you've been plastered with adverts on shakes and teas and carb-free fads and these crazy diets. And I think what Nigella's doing is kind of basically trying to relabel food is sustenance. She literally says food is sustenance, it's fuel. And I think that's so important because people, they're trying to eat right and they get so paranoid about, like, am I eating the right macros, micros, micros, or
the micro wave?
Yeah, I think that often the idea of overcomplicating food, it's aimed at women. And there's, I think, a couple of reasons for it. Partly it's because the industry is trying to make women insecure so that they can make money out of them. And I think the other reason, and this is maybe, I don't know if it's conspiracy theory-ist, but I do think that a part of it is to try and keep women in the kitchen and preoccupied about what they're making. So you can't just for example, Nigella recently had an episode on how to butter toast. You know, toast is fine, just butter toast, have it, you can have it in 2 minutes. But for some reason, we want people to be, I don't know, peeling kale and sprinkling orange zest and spending 2 hours creating like this healthy superfood salad, when actually that superfood salad probably has more calories in it because you've been putting all these extra fancy ingredients that you don't actually understand in, then you could have just had the toast.
I know that some people were critical of how simple her recipes were, though. I'm just thinking about, you know, her smashed avocado on toast when she did that. And that was already quite a kind of common thing that you'd find at brunch places. But she was making out as if it was, well, I think people didn't know why she wasted a segment on it because it was mm-hmm. so simple to put together. And I did actually hear people saying like, oh, did you see Nigella last night? Like, why do we need to be told how to do something so simple? But it's really interesting hearing her theory behind it because I didn't realise that before. So what I saw as her maybe oversimplifying, there's actually a reason behind it. So I'm really like interested to learn that.
Yeah, because then you get people. So for example, what's quite interesting is like, why does avocado and toast need to be this like holy grail, super healthy food? It's actually not. It, probably you could have Nutella on toast and it would be just as mm-hmm. not nutritious, but it's probably the same amount of calories. So I think she's just trying to say like, look, guys, this is so simple. You can just make this. It's, you don't need to go to a brunch at somewhere really expensive in Kensington. You can just make it at home.
That's so true. But I also think she never shies away from really rich, calorific food either. She likes to indulge. That's part of her brand, is indulgence. And I really appreciate that. It's not like you need an excuse to indulge with Nigella. Nigella's like, this is just a night in for me. I'm just making myself a chocolate cake.
I'm going to pad to the kitchen in the depths of night.
Yeah.
In a sort of...
in the negligee.
sort of reach into the fridge.
And I think also just kind of talking about Nigella's body, obviously women's bodies, as we've discussed in almost every episode, they're under lots of scrutiny. And I think she's probably what we would call mid-size. And what's quite interesting is that her body was seen as being like revolutionary. The fact that it was on television and seen as sexy during the 2000s, when actually... I'm sure if we saw her on the street, she's got a very normal body. Like,
She does. So I've met her. Well, sorry, I say I've met her. I haven't actually met her because, embarrassing story, she used to buy artworks from the gallery that I worked at and was very close to one of the artists who we represented. And she attended an art fair, which I was working. And I had got sort of dressed, just standard procedure for like art fairs, but hadn't appreciated that I'd forgotten to shave one of my armpits. Bought a razor, rushed to the loo to shave it. And whilst that was happening, Nigella had come, introduced herself to everybody, and then I just sort of arrived, sort of like ran in somewhat sweaty, freshly shaven, and just was too embarrassed to introduce myself. But she is stunningly beautiful. She just isn't perhaps the voluptuous individual you'd expect.
Is she actually skinnier in real life?
It's not the fact she's skinnier, it's also by the way that she dresses. She actually dresses in quite sort of like a, comparatively to what you see on TV, a masculine manner. So mm-hmm. she, each time I saw her, was wearing a very nicely tailored suit, but it didn't in any way like accentuate her curves. It just was very chic, very classic, quite like Bianca Jagger. She was wearing white on both occasions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess like kind of to your point about the language she uses in her show, I'm sure she also accentuates herself for the show as well. And that's part of her brand as well, as being this domestic goddess, which you do think of like a 1950s hourglass person. That's kind of her brand.
We could talk, interestingly, when it comes to sustenance, in the case of Mrs. B, about the toast sandwich, which I was just looking up before the episode. She came up with ideas in her book about how families could feed themselves on limited means, and one of her notions was this concept of a toast sandwich, so a piece of toast between two pieces of bread. I mean, I'm surprised Nigella hasn't picked up on this as a lover of toast, but there's definitely sort of something there.
Wow. That's such a depressing idea for a meal, isn't it?
I'm just actually like, you know, when someone describes something, I can literally taste that, like the texture of it.
Yeah.
It's so dry.
The squishiness and the crunchiness.
Yeah.
Not good.
No.
Did Mrs. Beaton touch upon nutrition, how families should feed themselves?
Absolutely. I actually think that she had a massive impact. So she wrote extensively about food preparation and meals, including the origins and characteristics of different produce. I actually have a 1960s copy in my kitchen, and she has these really detailed illustrations of like every single part of an animal. I think that's something that people might not have had before to hand. So I think that probably really helped people understand what part of a creature that they were actually consuming. And she also talked about the nutritional value and also what was in season, what you could cook with at different times of the year, which would have been common knowledge to people in the countryside, but people in cities wouldn't have had that same connection with the countryside. So I think that's really important. And her book was revolutionary in the way that it was organized. So it listed the components or ingredients before describing the cooking process, which is exactly how we work today. And you kind of can't imagine it any other way. But at the time, that was brand new. So people were kind of actually looking at everything that went into a meal and understanding how they combined to go into a meal. Again, it's like modern, a very modern way of looking at it. And she also included the approximate cost for a meal and how many heads it would feed. So that's really important for when you're trying to plan for a family. And prior to this, presumably recipes were kept in the family and passed down generations. But suddenly you had this accessible book, but we'll talk about the word accessible because obviously not everyone was reading Mrs. B. And it contained really important nutritional information, which might have been the first time that this was on some people's radars.
I heard when her recipes were serialised, you'd only get a part of them. So you'd be sort of reading about how to make, for example, the fruit Christmas pudding, and you'd get to, say, put the sugar in, and then it would just end there, and you'd have to buy the next copy of the paper to find out, well, sort of like how the recipe ended.
Her and her husband were so crafty.
Yeah.
They just knew how to, like, capture an audience and make them keep buying. But yeah, it's a bit of a cop-out, isn't it?
It's like an episode of EastEnders.
Exactly, kind of like serialisation of comics in the sun, where
yeah.
It's like an ellipsis. Do you think Mrs. B's manual, which helped them in the kitchen, in fact kept them within it?
Well, I think this is a really thorny issue with a few different answers to explore. So I want to lay them out for you and then I want to like break them down because it's really, really interesting. So at first glance, you might think, yes, you're, you know, supporting the cult of domesticity. This is a tome described as a formidable body of domestic doctrine, and it definitely emphasizes the role of middle class women in the home, setting very high standards for ladies and their domestic help, almost turning it into an art form. However, there is another side to Mrs. Beaton. She was, in fact, very against the grain for the time, being a professional woman herself, a published author and an equal partner of her husband in marriage and business. There are accounts of her riding on the train to his office daily in the commute, the only woman in the carriage very often. And this in itself bucks the idea that she was an anti-feminist figure. So I think there's a massive paradox between the way she lived her life and the way that she wrote.
Yeah, and I think that's the same with Nigella as well, because when she was writing How to Eat, talking all about sort of parties and having friends over, her husband was actually dying, so it probably been very difficult for her to have friends over, and the sort of this vision of domestic bliss that she was projecting was very different to her actual reality.
Yeah, definitely. So it is a little bit kind of confusing because she was definitely encouraging people in her written work that encouraging women that their domestic world should be their own kingdom. And she definitely wasn't promoting them going out and getting a career like herself, but that was something that she enjoyed. So you could see her as being a bit of a hypocrite, I suppose. But lastly, you could consider the view that by documenting the complexity and rigor that women went through to run their homes efficiently, that she actually elevated this and brought it into the public sphere, therefore giving the women the recognition for the domestic prowess that they really deserved. So there's so many different ways to unpick this particular one. And remember that this is only 50 years before women got the vote. So I don't think we can lay the blame for women remaining at home solely at Mrs. B's door. But I'm actually not sure which one of these views I agree with. I'd love to get your thoughts on it.
I think definitely the final thought or the final question around whether she's actually giving women the social labour recognition that they need, that's one that people are still having today.
I think it's a step in the right direction, but I don't think it's necessarily the exact solution that we all would like to have today. It's wonderful to be able to receive advice on how to do things that women might be interested in, but equally, it's terrible when you feel that you have no choice in doing them. And I wonder if Mrs. B's book made that feel like more of a obligation as opposed to a freedom.
I think what's quite interesting is obviously she was a massive influence later on, and I'm going to apologise for my pronunciations up front. Later on, we had August Bebel, who wrote Die Frau und der Sozialismus. Die Frau und der Sozialismus, well, in 1887.
There goes our German audience.
Bye, Caroline. And he he actually believed that women should be free to work. And I guess kind of building on the argument that you said about Mrs. Beaton, is he thought that if the work at home was efficient, then it would give women more freedom, it would give them more time. So in that sense, it's almost what they're looking at is this idea of efficiency. And I think efficiency and productivity is something that this idea of like making things simple. And then actually, if you do that, then rather than faffing around the kitchen, you're suddenly going to get hours back in your day. So you're actually able to go and do other things. And obviously, Bebel is saying so they can go and work.
But we're so far off, like that Bebel's basically saying, so you have to excel at everything at home, so much so that then you can go out and work, but you still need to do both. Whereas exactly. Men will only ever have to do one. So to be honest, we're probably still somewhat in that situation now. We're not even equal now.
Exactly. And I think we then have it where Christine Frederick, who she's like the American version of Mrs. Beaton, but in the 1920s, 30s. So she wrote a book that was quite famous called The New Housekeeping. And it had 12 principles of an efficient scientific home. And what I loved about it was, this is a quote from the book. The homemaker takes countless steps and motions in every task, many of which are entirely avoidable. And she and her husband literally advocated motion studies to measure the efficiency of how a woman performed in the kitchen. And they came up with the idea of like a swiveling stool. So you'd sit on your stool, you swivel around, and you can like...
There's a really good podcast called Herstory on the Rocks, and they covered her, I believe, recently, and it's a really good episode. I mean, it's thanks to her that we have the work life in which we do, the good aspects of it.
But she basically advocated for so much of what we see in the modern kitchen. For example, linoleum, lighting. She actually came up with the exact measurements of what, like, a sink and certain utensils should be based on like women's forearms and like how you could do the minimal amount of stirring, for example. But I do think a lot of her stuff all stems from Mrs. Beaton and the idea of domesticity being a science, kind of crediting women's work in the kitchen as actually being a labor, and then also trying to simplify it. But yeah, so they have a massive impact on architecture. And basically what we see is that the hearth in the kitchen becomes the center of the household. And what previously you would see before is actually quite a lot of people would have multiple parlours. And they basically advocated that you should only have maximum one. You don't need that much space. Uh-huh. And then I guess kind of fast forwarding time, we can even see this debate about women and labour today with this. There's a really excellent account on Instagram called Mother Pucker. And so she basically advocates for the idea of like flexi time and women, or not women, but anyone who looks after a child, that labour actually needs to be recognised, and employers need to, I guess, be flexible. The government needs to find ways around not just looking at traditional work as being rewarded.
But would they argue that child benefit caters to that? As in, I'm just wondering if you put this to the government as a theory, would they say, well, yeah, we already cover that?
Yeah.
Do you think it's, but does Mother Pucker want to go so much further than that?
Yeah. And I think it's really difficult because how can you make it equal? Because someone's got to look after the kids.
Well, how do you measure it as well when our system is set, is designed in such a different way?
I don't think we're going to solve sex.
But we're trying. To me, a big thing about Mrs. Beaton is that she was catering towards then a newly established middle class. Could you tell me more about this?
So I got very excited about this. So I'm sorry, I'm just going to jump in. So obviously, as we kind of discussed with Mrs. Beaton and her predecessors, they often gave very granular details on how to perform certain household duties. And these were duties that would generally have been performed by the middle class. So one of the key criticisms is the fact that they failed to take account of single parent families, for example. Often the manuals actually just forgot that there's tasks involved in looking after children. So it would describe how to create maybe quite an elaborate feast, but actually forgets that, say, for example, with Mrs. Beaton, you've got, or her, the household that she grew up in, they've got 21 kids running around, which is basically like an entire school.
But I also suppose like the middle classes that she's writing for would probably have governesses, housemaids to look after the kids to an extent.
But they might not be used to, that might be something that would be new to their lives. And so I think she has tips on, for example, stopping your butler from drinking your sherry, so where to hide your alcohol to stop the servants from getting to it, and another bizarre one on how to behave when you go to visit a friend. So say, for example, if I were allowed to your houses, I didn't know what to do, I could refer to Mrs. Beaton's manual, and she would tell me not to bring my children around unless they were very well behaved, and certainly not to bring my dogs. So I'm sorry, Theo wouldn't be invited.
So, but what I find really funny about it is that, you know, we keep saying the newly created middle class or an expanding middle class, but it would have only been like a generation or maybe two generations since these people were in the same position as these domestic servants. So it must feel like maybe even more painful as a domestic servant in that setting, that you're serving someone who's not even that posh. You're just like, you're basically the same as me, yeah, but I'm having to serve you. Like, it must have sucked.
But what's quite interesting actually is that one of the key criticisms is about the fact that they often refer to servants. And Nigella was highly criticized for this when she first started out, because she said, I think it was on a BBC radio show, where she referred to the fact that she had someone else do her shopping. And I think because she'd tried to portray herself as, or she tried to differentiate herself from her father, who's a conservative politician.
Yeah.
And then people were like, well, you are still quite posh.
I didn't know that. That's really fascinating. I think, yeah, I do remember that. There's a big thing about her turning out that she had a big team behind her helping create the recipes. And I think it all blew up over this Rocky Road recipe where the measurements were really off. And it came to light that that was because it hadn't been created by her. It had been created by a team who just made a mistake. So I think she sort of like came out of an apology saying, I'm sorry, you know, my team of Nigellas messed up here. So
it is kind of interesting because neither of them, Mrs. Beaton or Nigella, are really cooks at heart. Like, Nigella was a journalist, is an amazing writer, is obviously quite an academic. Mrs. Beaton was a really good writer as well, a good collator of information. But neither of these women are actually domestic goddesses when you think about it. Like, Nigella, like you say, she actually wasn't checking these recipes closely enough to know that what she was putting out was wrong. And then anyone who knew baking would read it and immediately go, like Mary Berry would read it and go, this is off. Like, she would know. So I do find it quite interesting that they're both kind of touted as domestic goddesses when it's just a veneer, really, isn't it?
It's a veneer. I stumbled upon quite a funny fact about Mrs. Beaton. Only one recipe from her book was created by her. The rest is just gross plagiarism, something that was very common practice. Well, was common practice.
It's just that I find it hilarious that the one recipe that is legit was her soup. And this soup was christened as the soup for benevolent purposes, because it was supposed to be for the poor over the harsh winter of 1858 to 59. And this firmly establishes that her readers were women of means, women who could afford to give food away to charity or to the poor. And it totally excludes those of the lower classes to even wanting to access her book or really having any affinity to it at all. And I think Nigella is a little bit in the same bracket. Like, does she really appeal to the working classes, like her recipes? We're being honest with ourselves, they're quite decadent, and sometimes the ingredients are very exotic. And, you know, she'll go into her larder and go, this kind of pasta you can only get from this deli in North London. It's very, very specific.
Also, actually, what's quite interesting is, I know we talked about Germany and how Germany's obviously influenced both women, but in the late 1920s, the, I guess, German version of Mrs. V and Nigella, Erna Mayer, she actually very much focused on giving working class women more of their time back. So again, I guess it's looking a bit at like Bebel, but it's about giving women more freedom. And a lot of her literature was very much focused on the working class. And I think perhaps what we see is in the US and Britain, home economics was probably more about consumerism and trying to persuade people to buy products, a bit like Mrs. Beaton saying, come back next week, folks, to find out how to make your jelly ham.
Yeah. Now to the subject of relationships. Becky, tell me about Mrs. B's relationship with her husband.
Well, first things first, he was quite a sexy guy. We're going to share a picture of him on our Instagram. Honestly, I can definitely see what she saw in him. They actually had a really romantic relationship. They courted for a long time. She used to meet him on his train back from work at a certain station. They'd go and have tea together in a tea house. They wrote love letters to each other that she signed from Fatty, which I hope isn't supposed to reference her physique. I think she looked like a very attractive woman. I hope that was supposed to just be like funny.
Quick question. You know, you said that she met him on his train journey. Was this by accident, or was this purposeful? Was she like, I'm going to meet you there? Not just, oh, I just happened to be at the station for the last 5 hours. What a coincidence.
I think it was on purpose. I think they had a little appointment that they'd keep, okay, and it was just really cute. So yeah, I think they had genuinely a really good relationship. His sisters attended actually the same school in Heidelberg where she was sent. So they definitely had connections and they were kind of from a very similar area in London and moved in the same circles. But it wasn't all rosy. So her husband, as we've mentioned, may have had syphilis contracted from a liaison with a prostitute before they were married, possibly causing her to have 2 miscarriages and perhaps even her eventual death. But at the end of the day, they were a great professional partnership. She accompanied him on all of his business trips to Paris, for instance, and he definitely saw her as an equal, and she was considered to have the better business acumen of the two. So he was a bit of a, he's like me, he's a spendthrift, he just loves petty money. And she was like, rein it in. So he really needed her alongside him. And he obviously loved her very much, because after she died, he actually wrote a tribute in a revised publication of her book. And the quote goes like this: her works speak for themselves, and although taken from this world in the very height and strength, and in the early days of womanhood, she felt satisfaction so great to all who strive with good intent and warm will of knowing herself regarded with respect and gratitude.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
And something else that I find really interesting is, before I was researching her, the name Mrs. Beaton to me conjured up image of a very matronly woman. I don't know what you thought about her, but I thought of her as being, you know, maybe in her 40s or 50s or something. No idea, she died when she was 28. And the reason that a lot of people have this image of her is because after she died, her husband had to sell the rights to her book to a different publishing house because she wasn't there to rein him in anymore, and he ran out of all his money. And that publishing house basically stifled any knowledge of her death, or tried to, so that they could continue to use her image to sell more books and pretend that she was still alive. So a lot of people who hadn't read the announcement that she died would have just continued thinking that she was writing recipe books, but it was all done by them. So it's quite sad that her image got used without her knowledge, or
yeah, without her involvement.
Yeah.
So Nigella was first married to the writer John Diamond, and this seems to have been a real love match, much like Mrs. B's. But unfortunately, he died of throat cancer early on into their marriage. She went on to marry the businessman Charles Saatchi, but this ended disastrously. Can you tell us more?
So I was thinking about this, and I think one of the things that really frustrates me about the whole, I guess, Nigella and Saatchi relationship is that, as we've discussed, Nigella is such a successful and highly accomplished woman. And I think particularly because, I mean, Saatchi pretty much openly abused her. And what just frustrates me is how one of the first things we think about when we think about Nigella is we think of Saatchi. And actually, I think he's a complete bastard who just almost doesn't even deserve us like to talk about him, because this is an episode about her. It's not about him. And I think there's literal photos of it. I think also the fact that he spent such an effort to muddy her name after the relationship really shows that he's actually just a momentous dick. So I'm not even going to talk about him. He's an asshole. And I think one of the other, I guess, areas that I guess we could kind of talk about would be the fact that obviously he did try to bring up the fact that she obviously used drugs, and she admitted that as well.
She did. She had quite a personal line which said, I didn't have a drug problem, I had a life problem. I don't think it was just him that brought it up. She had 2 assistants that worked for her and him, and they sued them because they believe that they'd used their bank cards illegally. They sort of they committed fraud, and they'd said that they'd seen Nigella using cocaine habitually, or evidence that she'd been using it. And she described her relationship with her first husband John Diamond and explained how when he was coming to the end of his life, he really wanted to almost sort of go out of a bit of a bang, and so had a bit of a party lifestyle, which sometimes she engaged in. But she had so many supporters, and I think actually the way that she handled the case made us love her more. I think she's been masterfully able to distance herself from it, and I think has come out as a really, really strong woman. Yeah. Someone that we really respect and admire in the UK.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that actually had come out was, obviously, initially I think there was a bit of a backlash, like, oh my gosh, Nigella's doing cocaine and smoking weed. But like, actually, why is it so controversial that she would take drugs? I mean, I think it's well known that women during the 50s and 60s took drugs in order to be able to perform their household duties. That's been no surprise. And actually,
and chefs as well. That's well known in the industry.
Exactly. And I think the other thing is, particularly around the time that she was kind of at her peak, drugs were so glamorized. So for like men, like in rock and roll bands, like we all knew that they were doing drugs.
Yeah.
But then also the idea of like heroin chic. So like these kind of like model waif thin women, they almost wanted to give the illusion, and they probably were all doing drugs, but they wanted to give the illusion that they were doing drugs. So like, why is it so controversial that this like domesticated woman could also be doing drugs? I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not
getting it's a drug. It's just though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just like two environments that you don't expect to mix. The idea of Nigella in her kitchen and the idea of recreational drug use doesn't seem like two worlds that would ever collide. But I don't judge her for it, weirdly. I think to your point, Ellen, because she was so elegant in the case, and also she had been so wronged, and the fact he brought it up was literally to drag her name through the mud, which felt so petty. And you're going to be on the side of someone who is the victim and just having that brought up to blacken their name.
But I think a parallel to Mrs. Beaton's life, turning to Tina Jella's first relationship, is the fact that it was her husband who really encouraged her to take up cooking and start publishing. He thought it would be a great distraction for her when he was suffering from cancer. Mm. And he was also the one who encouraged her to dress in a slightly more sexy way. He didn't sort of necessarily, like she said, boss her around or sort of force her to do it. But he said, you might consider presenting this image of yourself. And so it's partly thanks to their partnership that Nigella is the person that we know and love. Now to my favourite section, the quickfire round. I am going to fire a couple of questions at Becky and JC. So to begin, which song do you think sums up Nigella's and Mrs. Beaton's life?
Yeah, I think Mrs. Beaton, I think of her as a really wholesome person, to be honest. I think I'd go with My Favourite Things from The Sound of Music. I can just imagine her singing about brown paper parcels, kittens and delicious cakes.
That's so wholesome. I don't think Nigella would be as wholesome in her music choice. I think we were saying previously that I could, for some reason, envision her like dancing to dubstep or like rave music. In terms of like a song that I think of when I think of Nigella, it would probably be something classic, like a Frank Sinatra Christmas song or
some jazz.
Yeah, some smooth jazz. That's what I imagine when she's cooking. She's got some like smooth, when probably in reality she's got like
funny you should say that, Josie, because I've got Nigella's Desert Island Disc selection in front of me. And you're kind of barking up the right tree with your dubstep. Who do you think her favourite rapper is? She includes a rap song on her Desert Island Disc.
50 Cent. Eminem.
Yes. She chose Cleaning Out My Closet by Eminem as one of her songs. She also has Wheatus, Teenage Dirtbag, Boney M, Daddy Cool, which is very cute.
Oh, yeah, she seems like a bit of a disco queen.
I love Boney M. Mm.
Yeah. And slightly more sort of like sanguine are the Archies of Sugar Sugar, which I think she didn't say this, but I imagine it's because she, like most of her recipes have a high sugar content. Mm. So.
That would have been a good one to pick.
Oh, God. Well, she did it for you. Which Christmas song, actually, on the same topic, do you think sums them up, or which do you think they'd be playing at the moment?
Mrs. B, probably something very classic, like White Christmas, something that you imagine a family gathered around a piano, singing together, swaying, fireside, Little Women style.
Because you've just revealed that Nigella has a slightly alternative music taste, I'm going to go with My Chemical Romance's version of All I Want for Christmas Is You.
That is so funny because My Chemical Romance is on the list as one of the songs.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you. That is brilliant. Okay, you obviously know the ins and outs of Nigella. I was going to say Eartha Kitt, Santa Baby, because
I thought
Nigella's a sex pot.
Yeah, good one.
Okay, would you rather eat Nigella's Marmite pasta or Mrs. Beaton's calves, brains, cakes? And yes, ladies, that is a thing.
100% the pasta. I love Marmite personally. So
yeah, I like Marmite too. Marmite with cheese on toast. Mm.
That was an easy one. So you have to organise a dinner party. Just as you're about to start preparations, would you rather have a BBC film crew descend upon your house or a group of ravenous Victorians?
I think the ravenous Victorians, because they'll be happy with anything, whereas I think the crew might be a bit more picky.
I think I don't know why, but in my mind I'm picturing these ravenous Victorians as like zombie creatures. So the BBC film crew, I'm imagining like they're literal Victorians, so they're very, very old.
The only thing though, probably as a caveat, is that you wouldn't have hair or makeup unless we broadcast on Christmas Day, so just bear that in mind. I've got quite a few would you rathers here, so please forgive. Would you rather, like Nigella, go to a Piers Gav ball in Oxford, bear in mind it's a party in a field with publicly school educated toffs, or attend a Victorian ball? It's all much for muchness, really, but...
A Victorian ball, I think. Although I can't really imagine what that would actually be like. Were they Scrooges? Were they fun?
I think, again, it's like a perception thing. I think we think of Victorians as being stuffy, but that's just one perception of one particular group of Victorians, when actually... Think about Nancy in the bar, Papa. She knows how to have a good time.
I once played her in a pantomime.
Was it the red hair, Ellen?
I didn't have red hair at the time. Sorry, oh. Not a natural red.
Damn it. Talking of which, I know I talk about this all the time, but TikTok, I saw there's a great clip where this one woman is showing these old Victorian mirrors. Have you heard of these mirrors where they used to have them? Are they called trick mirrors or pocket mirrors, sorry, that the Victorians used to have? And they have pictures of women on them with their arms out. What you do is you turn the mirror upside down and it looks like a woman's legs with her vagina poking out her skirt.
No.
Again, we can link to this on our Instagram.
Wow.
They are dirty, dirty people.
Yes.
Question for Becky. Do you think Josie secretly works for TikTok?
Yes.
Would you rather eat 20 eggs as Nigella had to do for a bet once, or run a Victorian household for a day? You'd have servants, but you'd be joining them in the chores.
It's only for a day. I would definitely. Also, I'd love to see the inside of a Victorian household. Can I wear Victorian clothing? Because if I can, then I'm totally down. I will scrub any house. That would be so cool.
Yes, but I think you're thinking that Victorian clothing is probably quite easy to wear, whereas corsets would have been stifling, and also you'd have a big hoop skirt, which we'll come to in a second. Isn't that impressive that Nigella ate 20 eggs? For about once.
That's weird.
I'm just thinking,
what kind? Like, what? Hard boiled?
I'm assuming hard boiled. Oh, but she's like cold ham leek, isn't she?
It's fucking nuts.
I'm just thinking of the constipation.
Mm-hmm. Nigella doesn't get constipated, she's too perfect.
Nigella doesn't poo.
choose between living in a household surrounded by Charles Saatchi's art, including Mark Quinn's sculpted portrait made from his own blood, or a house decorated in a Victorian style but without a toilet.
I think to your point about Saatchi, him, I'll just go to the house with no toilet. Rather be there than in anywhere he's been.
From a shitter to no shitter.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is this also including Tracy Emin's shit in a bed, or is it not? Is it shit in a bed?
It's not. I don't think so, but that's brilliant.
Last question. What would be worse, wearing Nigella's four-piece suit on a beach or Mrs. Beaton's crinolines?
Well, the crinoline 100% would be worse. Like, they're so ridiculously big. And Ellen, is this the opportunity to share the horrible fact about crinolines?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. So me and Ellen and Josie, actually, we went to see Little Women this time last year.
Oh my gosh.
I was weeping next to Josie.
I didn't even know him that well.
It was actually me and Hermione were both crying. That's how we became friends. We were sausage just being like, honestly, it's just a bit of grit in my eye.
But I shared a very gruesome fact after that, because there were lots and lots of crinolines in Little Women, and you notice how large the hoops are and how close they are to lots of candles and fireplaces. Like, it's very nerve inducing watching it. And actually, the second biggest cause of death for women after giving birth, as poor Mrs. Beaton understood, was actually catching your crinoline catching fire and you burning alive in a room and no one being able to help you. So yeah, but if I'm on a beach, I'm not near any naked flames, so I suppose it would be okay to be in a crinoline. Yeah, it sucks.
Do you remember those pictures of Nigella on the beach, though, and what was called a burkini, but I think that's one of the
terminology. Yeah, burkini. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think as fellow pale moly people, actually, I think Nigella, definitely, she's got great skin.
She does. It's all thanks to that one-piece suit on the beach.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us for this festive fun episode. We do hope you have a lovely Christmas, and we'd like to thank you for hanging out with us virtually in 2020. In 2021, we hope to be doing more collaborations, and we're on the lookout for more comparisons. So if you have two people in mind that you'd like us to cover, please do get in touch. Our email address is femfilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Goodbye.
FemFas. FemFas. FemFas.